Good morning. So, last time we talked a bit more about how writes are done, and I mentioned that we have these thing called write buffers, where when we're performing a write in our cache, we don't typically need to wait for that write to complete at the next level. Instead, we have, yes? Yeah. Oh, yes, that's better. Okay. So, mentioning we have write buffers, so when we perform a write in a cache, we don't typically have to wait for the next level to respond. Instead, we have some storage for writes that are in progress. As long as that doesn't get full, the writes can kind of just happen in the background. If it does get full, of course, we're going to have to actually wait. And this means that our write-through policy is not nearly as bad as it seems, and that when we have the case of a write-back policy and we read something that requires sending out something that was dirty to the next level, it's usually not going to cause us to wait for that read. I'll also talk generally about this cache hierarchies, mentioning we have lots of caches. You have to do something that's not going to be a topic of this course to keep them all in sync. And then we talk sort of generally about sort of measuring cache performance. So previously we had talked about sort of types of misses, but we also know there's some cache optimizations which sort of aren't about fixing the miss rate, but are about other aspects of cache performance. And we learned this average memory access time formula, where we had these three components. We had hit time, so the amount of time it takes on an access that is a hit. We had miss penalty, the additional time we would need if we had a miss, typically the time we'd spend going to the next level. And the miss rate, just how often do we have hits and misses. And if we're thinking about choosing the best design for a cache, we'll look at, well, if I run programs, which sort of aspects do I want to change to improve my performance? And we'll target our optimizations that way. Then we started talking about mapping C code to cache accesses. So one thing we need to do is we need to realize what sort of instructions actually access the cache and what don't. So like, it's our instructions that in our five-stage processor would use the data memory or the instruction cache, instruction memory, which is the instruction cache. Those are things which access the cache. And for the most part, we're going to be focusing on the data cache because that's what we as a programmer have really the most control over. We mentioned that, well, we can sort of track the contents of a cache over accesses, kind of like what we've been doing like in the lab yesterday. Mentioned this idea of alignment, that if we're accessing like an array, it's probably better if it starts at the beginning of a cache block, or at the least doesn't overlap between two cache blocks with a single element. And this is typically something compilers do for us. And we started mentioning sort of what if we have lots of sets in our cache, how do we like figure out by hand what's going on? I mentioned that a big help is that we can kind of just look at one set at a time. So if we have like 1,000 sets, we don't need to actually like make a table with 1,000 columns about what's in each set. We just do one and then the other and then hope there's a pattern. And we're gonna finish up talking about that. Before I do that, questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So, a logistical note before I move on. I'm out of town Monday through Thursday next week. Professor Tkanovich will be covering this lecture and the other lecture. My office hours will not be held Monday or Wednesday. My Friday office hours will still be held, and I'll try to be responsive on Piazza. I better have internet access or that conference is screwed up because it's hybrid. Just to let you know. Okay, so let's get back to where we were. I think we just got to this exercise. So we're looking at how these accesses happen in the cache. And here I have a two-set cache with 8-byte blocks. Remember, our 8-byte blocks store two array elements, and we're Going to assume again that array zero is at the beginning of a block, just to make things simpler. So the question is, how many cache misses do we have with this code? And to start figuring this out, so remember that our blocks are two array elements. And the assumption I usually make is I just say, let's assume the beginning of the array is in set zero. That might not be true, but in that case, we're just renumbering the sets. We're not going to change the number of misses. So this would be set zero. This would be assigned to set one. And the next thing would be assigned to set zero because we only have two sets. Question?
Can we assume that array 0 starts at the beginning of a block?
Yes, let's assume array 0 starts at the beginning of a block. And because the answer would be different if that was not true. I should have written that on the slide. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we're going to have two misses? Three or four misses? Five or six misses? Seven or eight misses? Okay, so we have consensus, and it is, in fact, eight. And the same thing happened that we saw in our earlier one-set example. Having two sets didn't help us. And again, we can look at one set at a time. So 0 and 1 and 4 and 5 are the only things that map to set 0. So we can just look at the axis of the dem. We access 0, then 4, then 1, then 5. And 2 and 3 and 6 and 7 are the only things which map to set 1. We can look at them alone. We have 2, then 6, then 3, then 7. Okay, so we've done a bunch of toy examples. Let's do something that's less of a toy example. And let's, again, just to keep things simple, let's assume array 0 is at the beginning of a cache block. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, most people, okay. Enough people, at least. So, the first step I did is I realized, oh, four array elements fit in a cache block. 16 byte blocks, four array elements. Okay, who'd still like some more time? Okay, so let's see. So who thinks we have less than 100 misses? Between 100 and 200. People, between 200 and 300. Majority, between 300 and 500. Okay, so between 500 and 700. More than 700. Okay, so it looks like a majority of people figured out the number of misses, which should be 256. So there's a couple ways you could figure this out. So one thing I could do is I could say, oh, when I access a block of this cache, block of this array, like the elements 0 through 3, I access it four times, for 0, then 1, then 2, then 3, and then I never access it again. So with that reasoning, I don't even need to worry about what set things are in, because I'm also not accessing any other blocks, so there's no possibility of, while I'm accessing it, being replaced. So I can just count how many blocks there are. And the blocks are 4 array elements. Why 4? Because we have 4 byte array elements, times 4 is 16 bytes, which is the block size. So I take 1024 divided by 4, get 256. Another way I could have reasoned about this is I could have said, let's look at set 0, assuming array of 0 is stored in set 0. Then the other things in set 0 are going to be multiples of 2 kilobytes away from it. Why 2 kilobytes? Because if we think of how we originally set up our direct map cache, we're like, we mapped the first row to the first block, second row to the second block, until we ran out, and then we went back around, and that's going to take 2 kilobytes with a direct map cache, because we have to go through 2 kilobytes worth of blocks. So array of 0 and array of 512 map to the same block. So I think of, when do I access the block containing 0? Well, I access that in the first few iterations of the loop. So that's going to happen once. And when I access something in set 0 next, so when I'm accessing 512, that's going to replace the thing in 0, and I'm never going to get reuse out of that. And I can then say, OK, so that's set 0. And I can look at set 1 and realize, oh, it's the same thing, just with slightly different numbers. And that's true all the way up to set 255. So that would be another way of reasoning it. I have those 256 sets there. Each of them, or not 256, all the way up to set 128. And so there are 128 sets there, each of which where we access two blocks, have misses, and have 6 hits. Total. 3 on each of the blocks. Yes? So question, in this question, we have one miss for each block, yes. So the first time we access it has to be a miss. Then we have 3 hits when we access it for the next 3 elements in the block. We have the miss for the first element of the block, like 0 for the first block, then hits for 1, then 2, then 3. Okay, so questions about, I reasoned about this? Yes. How do I know there's 128 blocks? So if I have 2 kilobytes is 2 to the 11 bytes divided by 2 to the 4 bytes per block. So minus 7 is 2 to the 7 blocks. So there's 128 sets, and there's 1 block per set. So, other questions? Okay, so let's do the same variation of this we've been doing before. It's just Okay, who needs more time for the first question here? Minority. So, a little bit more, and then we'll. Yeah, and the second question is what a set associative cache would be better, which is. Okay, let's start with the first part. So who thinks we'd have between 200 and 300 misses? Okay, between 300 and 500 misses? Between 500 and 700 misses? Okay, over 700 misses? So most of you figured out, it looks like, that we're going to have 512 misses. And what happens here is our first loop accesses 0, then 2, then 4, then 6, and so on. And remember, our blocks are like 0 to 3, 4 to 7, and so on. So we have a miss for the 0, a hit for the 2, miss for the 4, hit for the 6, and so on. And then we have the second loop. And you might say, oh, but we access 0, so we brought in 0 to 3, so when we access 1, shouldn't be in the cache. But the problem is that we tried to bring in 4 kilobytes of blocks in the first loop, and that just simply won't work. Or a way we could analyze this more precisely is we could say that if we think of set 0 only, in this loop we bring in, we access 0 and 2, which brings in 0 through 3 into set 0, and then we access 5112 and 5114, which also map to set 0, which brings in 5112 through 517, or 7... 2 plus 3 is not 7, it's 515. And then in this loop, our accesses to set 0 are going to be for indexes 1, 3, 513, and 515. And, well, the access to 512 and 514 just evicted 0 through 3, so the 1 will be a miss. That's going to bring in 0 through 3, so we'll have, so I'll mark our misses. So we'll have a miss, then a hit. And then bringing in 0 through 3 took out 512 through 515, so now we have another miss, then a hit. So questions about how I figured that out? Okay, so then we have a second question. Would a set associative cache be better? So who thinks yes? Who thinks no? Okay, who thinks no clue? Okay, so if we keep the cache size the same, let's think about going to a two-way set associative cache. And that if I kept the set size the same, we now have more things that map to set 0. So even though we fixed the problem of only being able to store one block in set 0, now our access is to 256, and 258 would go to set 0, so we'd be storing 0 to 3 and 256 to 259. And then when we access 512, we'd have to evict one of those two blocks with a two-way cache. And with an LRU policy, what would be least recently used? It would be 0 through 3. So we'd end up having a miss later on from that. And we'd similarly end up evicting 256 when we accessed 768, the next thing which maps to the same set, and so on. So because if we keep the cache size the same, we're gonna have to map more things to the same set because we have less sets. It ends up being the case that more associativity would not help this. A bigger cache would help this. So if we had a 4K cache, we'd get back down to 256 misses. But if we just keep the cache size the same, but add associativity by basically increasing the number of columns, decreasing the number of rows, it's just going to be the same with this program. Yes?
How do you know that five twelve maps to index?
So the question is, how do I know that 512 is going to map to the same set as 0? So the way I figure that out is I said it's a 2K cache, and if it's direct mapped, that means that it's going to take, that's the size of a column in the cache, right? And when we think of going from set to set, we like put the first set 0 is at the top of the column, then we go to the next row in the column, and so on, until we wrap around. And that's going to take 2K of stuff, because there's 2K in a column. In our two-way cache, we have 1K in a column, so it wraps around after 1 kilobit. Question? Yes. So the reason why adding away doesn't, help our miss rate is because we have to have fewer sets to accommodate that. So no, because it will have fewer sets if it's the same size. Same total size. Total bytes. So, but yes, if it had more bytes. So if we had just a bigger cache, like if we made it a two-way cache by making it a 4K two-way cache, then yes, we'd have less misses. Yes.
If you made it like fully associative, then like.
So the question is, what would happen if it was fully associative? It still wouldn't help, because think of when we get to 512, the least recently used thing in the cache is going to be 0. When we get to 512 plus 4, the least recently used thing in the cache is going to be 4, and so on. So we're always, so in that last half of the loop, first loop, we'd always be evicting what the first half of the second loop wants. Question? So what if we had a bigger cache block? That would decrease the number of misses because there's more things in a block. But we'd have the same sort of thing with our, there's always going to be, if it's just still a 2K cache, always going to be two things in the array that map to the same block. Other questions? Okay, so I've shown kind of this sort of brute force way of counting misses. We're going to stop doing that now because it's very tedious and we want to talk about real programs, and this is not something that's really practical when our code gets more complicated. And I'm going to primarily use a way of approximating the number of misses in a much faster way, but it's going to be an approximation, so we're going to miss some details. Based on looking for good and bad temporal and spatial locality and reasoning from that, sort of an estimate of what the misses will be, and this is going to be a way we can get some sort of practical advice on writing programs that's going to have a lower miss rate. So typically I'm going to look at good and bad spatial and temporal locality, and also going to look at, so if I have like nested loops, the most important thing is what the inner loop does, because that's where most of our time is. So to start out, I have two pieces of code here, which are different. So which has better temporal locality in A, B, and C, and the same thing for spatial locality. And the difference between these two, if you haven't caught it, is that I've swapped I and J in the for loops. So the question, what do I mean by locality in array? Locality for the accesses to that array, reads or writes. question? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. Okay. Okay, so let's see. Okay, so let's start with temporal locality. So who thinks version 1 has better temporal locality for A? Okay, version 2, they're about the same. So I think a majority said 1, but there's some with 2. And I think 1 is better. And what I think about for this is, if I just wrote down what the accesses to A are, for version 1, what I'd write down would look like I'd read and write A of 0. I'd read and write A of 0 again. Then I'd read and write A of 0 again. And I'd do this n times. And then I'd read and write A of 1, and so on. And that's because the inner loop is on J, not I, so we repeat I equals 0 n times, then we repeat I equals 1 n times, and so on. For the second loop, if I wrote down the accesses to A, I'd get that I read and write A of 0, then A of 1, then A of 2, and then I read and write, you know, after n times, I go back to reading and writing A of 0, then 1, then 2. And our rule for temporal locality is that if we access something now, we're likely to access it again soon. So this seems it's like more true for our first example, where most of the time, if I see an access to an element of A, I'm going to access that element again next. versus the other case where it's going to be n accesses before I do it again. Question, yeah. Question is, why is A more important than B? Because I'm just asking about A. So, as for what the overall performance is, we have to think about how A balances with B. Other questions? Okay, so let's try our second part. So, who thinks for temporal locality in B, who thinks version 1 is better? Version 2, they're about the same. Okay, we have consensus here. Okay, now let's go to C. So who thinks for temporal locality version 1 is better? Version 2, they're about the same. Okay, and I would say they're about the same. And the reason I would say that is because I times n plus j is, or i's only go up to n minus 1. So every I and j gives us a different I times n plus j. So we're never accessing an element of C twice. So we don't have any. So if I look at my temporal locality rule, if I'm accessing it now, I'm accessing it again soon. Well, I'm never accessing it again, ever. And that's true in both cases, so they're the same temporal locality. Another spatial locality, probably, but that's not what I asked about. So let's go to, sorry, question?
So if you access the two addresses next to each other, does it help temporal locality?
So question, doesn't accessing two addresses next to each other help our cache performance? Absolutely, but that's because of spatial locality, not temporal locality. So let's talk about spatial locality. So let's start say, so where which is better spatial locality for A? Is it version 1? Version 2? Okay. And for B, version 1? Version 2? Okay, so this is a case where things get a bit tricky. So you're probably saying, oh, there's great spatial locality in A, because when we access 0, we access 1 soon. I would say this is usually a case we don't talk about spatial locality much in when we're accessing the exact same thing. There's a legitimate argument that it's better when we're accessing the exact same thing. We're not going to be concerned about that distinction. But the interesting case for spatial locality here is C. So who thinks version 1 has better spatial locality in C? Version 2? And they're about the same? Okay, so most people said version 1, and I would say version 1, 2. So if we think of the accesses to C here, we're accessing C of 0, 1, up to C of n minus 1, then we're accessing C of n plus 0, n plus 1, and so on. So we're accessing things in order in our first version. In our second version, if I look at the accesses to C, I'm accessing C of 0, C of n, C of 2n, and so on. So I'm accessing n apart most of the time. It's a little different when I go do another iteration of loop. So that's worse spatial locality. Some questions on how I figured out that spatial locality. Okay, so we can go beyond this sort of analysis of is the locality better or worse, and actually get sort of concrete estimates of the misses. We're going to miss some details of the cache, but some estimates. So for example, I have our first version of the loop here, and I'm counting the number of misses for the accesses to A. So if I think of the accesses to A, A at I, hopefully, because we have the good temporal locality, should always be a hit on everything but the first iteration of the inner loop, of the loop over J. And on the first iteration, we might have a miss, but we'll only have a miss if we haven't recently accessed something else from that block, which is going to be true, you know, only a quarter of the time. Why only a quarter of the time? If so, this is assuming four elements per block, because all the other times, the previous iteration of the I loop accessed some other part of the block of A that we're looking at. So like if, you know, initially we access A of 0, that brings in A of 0, 1, 2, 3. So the loops for I equals 1, 2, and 3 should have no misses on A, not just, you know, one miss. Yes?
Are we assuming that A, B, and C is not stored in the same cache?
This question is, are we assuming A, B, and C aren't stored in the same cache because I'm not accounting for interference? So not exactly, but this is why I'm calling it an ASCII, right? I'm not taking into account the effects of interference between A, B, and C. But yeah, the way I'm taking that into account is I'm saying this is an estimate. I'm assuming that the locality is going to be enough that with a good cache design, especially one that's like not direct map, we're never not going to have that sort of problem. But this is an approximation. But unlike actually taking that into account, it's way easier to figure out, and it's almost as useful. Or maybe more useful because you can figure it out quickly. So I estimated n over 4 misses to the access to A. So exercise, do the same for B and C. And note that we're assuming that n is very large. So one part of the assumption that n is very large is assume that that our cache can't fit n things. So if you try to access 0 to n and then go back to 0, we're going to run out of space in the cache, so 0 is not going to still be cached. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. Okay, so let's start with B. So who thinks our number of misses is n times or divided by a small constant? Okay, a couple people. Who thinks it's going to be n squared times or divided by a small constant? Who thinks we have something else? Okay, so a majority of people said it's going to be n squared plus some constant, and I get n squared over 4. So let's talk about how I get that. So first I look at the innermost loop and I say, okay, we're accessing n elements of B, going from 0 to n. So I'm going to have that same pattern we saw before of, you know, I access 0, that brings in 0 through 4, sorry, 0 through 3, I access 4, that brings in 4 through 7, and so on. So every fourth of those is going to be a miss, so our innermost loop here is going to be n over 4 misses the first time. And then the question is, well, the second time, is like B of 0 going to be in the cache again? And the answer is no, because we access everything in B after 0, and that's way too much stuff to fit in our cache because of the assumption that n is very large. If n was small, it wouldn't be bad, but n is very large. So that means that I'm going to have this happen each of the n times I run the outermost loop, I'm going to have n over 4 misses, because essentially it's going to be as if the cache is empty because I've accessed so much other stuff before I go back to B of 0. And so that gives me n squared over 4. So questions on how I came up with that answer? Okay. So let's go for C. So who thinks the number of misses for C is fewer? Who thinks it's the same? Thinks it's larger? Okay, so a couple people say larger. I think it is the same. And if we think about what happens with C, we never access an element of C twice, but basically we're doing C 0 through n. In the first iteration of the loop, when I is 0, then n through 2n, then 2n through 3n, and so on. So that's what we're doing. Each of those is going to be n over 4 misses each time. And we have n of them, so it's n squared over 4 again. So questions on how I figured this all out? Okay. So now let's look at sort of applying this sort of analysis to look at optimizing some code that like computes things that are arguably useful. I'm going to talk about matrix stuff because matrices are sort of a big practical case where cache performance comes up, matrix computation. And I'm going to store matrices as a 2D array, but I'm going to deliberately flatten it and show you the flattened form. So I'm going to do the I times n plus j to access row I, column j, or column I, row j, whatever your preferred notion is. But I'm not going to use a real 2D array, mostly so it's clearer how things are laid out in memory, because we're really concerned about that. So when I write I times n plus j, I really mean, you know, ij, but I'm writing it out, you know, without a 2D array to be very explicit about what the memory layout looks like. And I'm going to call the first index rows. So I'm going to be talking about matrix multiply, which hopefully you've kind of seen, but I'm going to show the formula anyways. And I'm going to choose to have the first index be rows and the second index be columns. So rows are going to be stored together in memory with this scheme. And if we think of what this means for laying out a matrix this way, the way our cache blocks work, if our cache blocks are 4 bytes, then rows tend to be part of the same cache blocks. Now, this is not entirely true, but that's why our previous thing was an approximation, right? It's not going to be true at the edges, but when we have big rows, mostly things in the same cache block are in the same row. So what we really want to do is we want to use data from the same row together when we do computations on a matrix. So let's apply this to our matrix multiply. And I can write matrix multiply like this. So this is what matrix multiply is. It's Ci of j is the sum of all Ai of k times Bk of j for all k, which I can write a loop like this that computes all the C elements. So this is just a very direct computation of this. And I have a choice here in how I order the loops. And yeah. And that choice is going to matter. And we're going to do the same analysis we just did to sort of figure out what makes sense. So if I look at, say, temporal locality, for example, you know, I have good temporal locality here and very bad temporal locality here. I have good temporal locality in the first version because I times n plus j stays the same as k changes. And in the second version, I times n plus j changes as j changes. And I can do similar here. So I have extremely poor temporal and spatial locality for B in the first version, but in the second version, I have pretty good spatial locality at least. And I can sort of do this systematically. I can look at A, B, and C and kind of figure out, you know, does this look like it should give us better performance based on the locality? And you can see that I'm not getting something perfect here. So that's something we'll have to deal with, that, you know, by making the accesses to, in this case, it's better, but it's still like I don't have good temporal locality in B, you know, after this change, and there's going to be a trade-off there. But we can actually kind of see here that this is probably just better in the second order because, you know, in the first order, A and B have pretty bad temporal locality B has horrible spatial locality too. And in the second order, A has excellent temporal locality and B has good spatial locality. So that probably ends up being better. Because if we consider, basically, we got to, from a case where B had no locality and C and A had some, to where C and B and A all have some locality, so we're all going to get some advantage of reusing cache blocks. And we could sort of systematize this by counting the misses overall. When I did X, so I think for time reasons, I'll just go over. So which is better for each of these? So if we think of spatial locality for accesses to C, well, they're probably about the same because our J loop is innermost here. Right? Or they're about the same, or maybe the first is better if we consider it accessing the same thing, spatial locality. For spatial locality and accesses to A, well, in this version, I'm going by K. In this version, I'm going by I before anything. So probably this has some spatial locality in A. As far as when we reuse things in a block, it looks better. Though, we all have repeated access. And accesses to B, if I think of spatial locality, it's definitely bad in the first version and better in the second. So this has good spatial locality. If I think of temporal locality, where do I have better temporal locality and accesses to C? Well, that's here. Where do I have better temporal locality and accesses to A? Well, that's definitely in the bottom version because when J changes, my index in A doesn't. Where do I have better temporal locality and accesses to B, that's definitely, well, so, it's not good in either case, but if I look at this second most innermost loop, it's I here, so I repeat accesses to the same thing in B, and it's J here, so I don't, because it's K and J, so I'm going through all of B before I go back to an individual element, so it's slightly better in the second version. Question, yes?
Yeah, so is it generally true that, if you have that, in the first version, C is good because, your I times N is all the way up to the first, outermost loop, and then J is inside of the I loop? That's why.
So the question is why C is better in the first version?
Yeah, or just in terms of loops.
In terms of question, C has better temporal locality in the first version because the index to C doesn't change in the innermost loop.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it's over K, not I or J. Yeah. Yes. So question, can we make the generalization that they both have better temporal locality? That one will have... So the question is, if I was only concerned about B, would I prefer the better spatial locality since the temporal locality is bad in both?
Or just, if there was a scenario with two versions, and for one variable there was better spatial locality, but the temporal locality was bad for both, would the temporal locality be slightly better for the one with better spatial?
So the question is, if I see better spatial locality, does that mean in... And the bad temporal locality, is the temporal locality always going to be better in the one with better spatial locality? And not necessarily. Okay. And another way we could kind of look at this, which might be a nicer visualization, is we can kind of draw out, in this case, these are matrices. And we can say that if we look at our innermost loop is doing one thing in C, So that's their good temporal locality. If I just draw out, I'm just drawing out the elements that are covered by the innermost loop in green. And it's doing a row of A and a column of B. And our row of A has lots of cache blocks that are together. Our column of B has a bunch of different cache blocks, so that's not so good spatial locality. And this is for the IJK order. If we have the KIJ order, I draw something different. So I have my good spatial locality in B, well, taking advantage of multiple cache blocks in B and C, and sort of the big advantage is that our innermost loop is going through rows into things, and that's why we would expect better performance, and in fact, if we measure it, we will get substantially better performance from that other loop order. Questions about sort of this diagram for showing this locality where I'm just drawing what the inner loop covers in each of our three matrices. Okay. And as I said, you can actually check the performance of this. So I did a benchmark where I measured the two versions of the loop, one with K on the outside, one with K on the inside. And I counted the number of instructions that were run, and it's the same, right? They're the same loop, I just changed the I and the K variables location. So it's the same number of instructions, I'm just like adding to different registers. But the amount of time it took, you know, for the K on the outside version is a lot better. And that's because we had that much better spatial locality overall. Yes?
Why is that spike on the blue one?
So the question is, what are these spikes? So this spike is exactly at the size of n equals 512. We also have sort of a more minor spikes at other things related to powers of two. And what's happening there is that our row size is related to a power of two, which means that things that are doing down a column might be close to this to the interval between two things that would map to the same set. So we get conflict misses because of that sort of power of two relationship. And particularly with 512, that really we get a whole lot of cases where when we go down a column, we get tons of extra conflict misses, even though I have an 8-way cache on the system. You know, there's still everything's mapping to the same set, effectively, so we got a very bad performance. Yes? The question is, I mean conflict between A, B, and C? No, I mean conflict between elements of one of the matrices. So if we think of what we're doing in the loops over, say, in this example, so an original example, if we think of B, what's happening when our n is 512, is that as we go down this column, we're tending to map to the same set relatively frequently. And so that's why we have lots of conflicts. Yes?
Go back to the origin site. What is the graph at the top?
The graph at the top is the number of instructions. So I haven't changed the number of instructions. I've just changed which ones of those are cache misses, and that's why my performance changed.
Do you mean number of instructions in the assembly file, or number of...
The question, do I mean the number of instructions in the assembly file? I mean the number of instructions executed. So I asked the processor to count how many instructions were executed and how many cycles it took.
So is the extra cycle in the bottom caused by stalling?
So the question, are the extra cycles caused by stalling? It's maybe a little more complicated than that, but essentially, yes. They're caused by waiting for the cache. Other questions? Yes?
So you're saying that dealing with cache affects number of cycles?
Question, I'm saying that dealing with cache affects number of cycles. When we have a cache miss, our memory access is slower. So I showed you sort of that example of, so we went through the locality, and we can do the same thing we did about counting misses. So here, a lot of our counts are going to be and third related. So I can do my same miscounting thing I showed you before on this example. So I can say this is our bad loop order. K is in the inside. And I say, OK, if n is really large, then for A, in the K loop, I have n divided by block size misses because I have that going through a row pattern. So it's nq divided by the block size in elements. And for b, in the k loop, I have n misses in each of those loops because I'm accessing just different elements, and each one is in a different block because I'm skipping by n. And for c, I have about 1 divided by the block size because I'm accessing the same thing over and over again, and in between iterations of the k loop, I'm accessing things that are going to be in the same block. And so that gives me sort of these misestimates, n cubed over 3, n cubed, n squared divided by the blocks, n cubed over the block size, n cubed, and n squared divided by the block size. So questions on how I did this analysis? This is the same kind of miscounting we did in our previous exercise, just with 3 loops instead of 2. Yeah. Question is, why am I dividing by block size? So in the case of A, because I'm adding K, I'm going A of, I'm starting at like A of N, or like I'm doing A of N plus 1, N plus 2, N plus 3. So I have that this phenomenon where if I access A of N plus 0, that's going to bring in A of N plus 1, N plus 2, and so on, depending on how big our block is. And the same sort of thing is true with C. When I access C of I plus n, I times n plus 0, that's going to bring in C of I times n plus 1, and so on. Yes?
Why are we assuming n is large? Don't we already have 8 megabytes of capacity?
So the question is, why are we assuming n is really large? So we'd have to do something more complicated to make a good estimate if n is smaller. So it's not that n can't be small, but if n is not really large, our estimates could become more complicated because we have to worry about what if things that are n apart could, we could store n things in the cache, then we have to worry about, does that actually happen? Yes?
So
the question is, the reason we're not dividing by block size for b is because j is going to make a jump around. It's because the k here is what the innermost loop is about. So we're going, so if we think of b, we're accessing like b of 0, b of n, b of n, 2n, and so on. And each of those are not likely to be part of the same block. Other questions? OK. And for the other version, our analysis just gets less misses. So this is a way we could have guessed that, one version had, that this version would have better performance without running it. Though, in practice, often what people do is they just try all the loop orders and see which performs best. Because that's easier than assuming that these estimates actually apply to your situation. You can just run them and test them. Yes?
If there's a miss in A but not in C,
if there's a miss in A and not in C, does C have to wait for A?
Yeah.
So it turns out, as we'll discuss later, that processors are really good at performing multiple memory accesses in parallel. We obviously don't know how to do that because our pipeline processor certainly can't. But in practice, processors can perform memory accesses in parallel, provided that it can compute the 2 addresses to be accessed in advance. Other questions? Okay, and I think I think we'll skip this for time. And we'll just start on this. So I'm going to talk about a trick that presumably Professor Shkodovich will go over in more detail because of our time situation. But I'm going to start here. And I have this transformation here. So I'm going to just take my loop over K and turn it into two loops. So hopefully you can see that this is not going to change anything versus just having a normal loop over K, except make my loop indexing more complicated. So any questions about this? So the reason I'm going to do this, so this useless change to the loop, is now I'm going to apply changing the order of the loops. And you might say, so why would I do that? Well, by doing this, I've improved slightly my spatial locality in A. And I've improved slightly my temporal locality in C. And I've hurt my spatial locality in B, but not by very much. And I still have most of my spatial locality in C and most of my temporal locality in A because J isn't changing. So I've kind of gotten a compromise between the good and bad things about the different orderings of those loops. And I can adjust this compromise, of course, by changing what this 2 is. And this version, in fact, is going to perform better. I just wrote it out a little more explicitly, but this version is going to perform, in fact, better than either of our orders in practice. Yes?
Are there any compilers which does this for you?
We'll get to that topic probably next week. The answer is sometimes, but there's a lot of things which make the compiler not be able to do it in practice. So we're going to talk more about this next time, and we're going to extend this to, so you've seen this done with one loop, why not do it with all the others? And we'll talk about doing that.